It is Tuesday, May 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will meet a high-ranking North Korean official in New York this week to negotiate on a possible summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. An attacker kills three people in Belgium just after his release from prison.
I think that it appears as though at this point that he may have discovered his extremist ideas while he was incarcerated.
And a Korean boy band produces music that's gaining in popularity around the world. It's all ahead. The White House says Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will meet later this week with a top North Korean official who's on his way to New York for talks related to a planned summit between President Donald Trump and North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un. Trump wrote Tuesday on Twitter, "Kim Yong-chol, the vice chairman of North Korea, heading now to New York." Hours earlier, video footage showed Kim Yong-chol at the Beijing airport before leaving for the U.S. The pace of diplomacy has quickened in recent days, with fresh reports of American and North Korean officials busily preparing for a potential U.S.-North Korean summit in Singapore next month. Meantime, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's de facto chief of staff, Kim Chong-sun, traveled to Singapore as a U.S. delegation prepares for the meeting between the North Korean leader and President Trump. Grant Newsham, senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty what is amazing to him is the apparent role reversal underway, with Pyongyang actively engaged in making sure the Singapore meeting takes place.
That's the first time ever that this has happened. In the past, this has always been the Americans, South Koreans, begging, bribing, trying to do anything to get the North Koreans to come and just talk. Here it's the North Koreans who appear to be desperate to have Mr. Trump come. And that is something very different. So this is quite a development to see finally in sort of the 25 years I've been following, to see the North Koreans desperate to get to the table instead of vice versa.
Why the change in attitude?
I think this is the first time there's been a president who has really put the military option on the table. Other presidents have even, such as Mr. Obama, have specifically said, well, we're not going to use the military option. Trump is something new, and his warnings that military force might be used, I think, have been taken seriously. Plus, there has been a fair amount of pressure compared to the past put on the Chinese economically.
Meanwhile, President Trump and Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe Monday agreed to meet ahead of Singapore, perhaps on the sidelines of the Group of Seven meeting in Canada on June 8th and 9th. International Security Studies professor Yoichiro Sato of Ritsumeikan Asia Pacific University said Tokyo is keen to understand the U.S. position ahead of Singapore.
Especially in regard to the perceived gap between the North Korea on denuclearization. The North Korea insists denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, whereas the United States has been somewhat flexible between denuclearization of North Korea as an official stance, but showing some degree of understanding toward the North Korean negotiating stance. So I think Abe wants to get the precise nuance of the U.S. policy.
I think aside from South Korea, Japan has to be the most interested party in this summit.
Japan has been strongly backing the U.S. stance on the CVID, complete, verifiable, irreversible disarmament of North Korea. For the U.S. to move from that means there's a great implication for Japan's standing, especially Japan's stance on the presence of U.S. troops on the Korean Peninsula.
Yoichiro Sato said any hint of a U.S. troop withdrawal would be met with alarm in Tokyo. He also said, aside from denuclearization, Japan hopes the matter of Japanese citizens abducted by North Korea will be on the Singapore agenda. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The United States says religious freedom is under assault around the world. Malaysia's 92-year-old prime minister seeks to implement reforms and restore the country's reputation. Hurricane Maria death toll in Puerto Rico is more than 70 times higher than the official government tally. That's according to a new study. And Starbucks' anti-bias training gets underway. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
For years, studies have shown that eating a diet that includes a lot of red and processed meat have been linked to cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and even cancer. Now, recent research by Israeli medical scientists have found that another disease can be added to that list, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, or NAFLD. According to the U.S. National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, NAFLD is a condition in which excess fat is stored in your liver. This buildup of fat is not caused by heavy alcohol use. There are two types of NAFLD. The most commonly diagnosed type is called simple fatty liver, which doesn't typically progress to cause liver damage or complications. But the other more advanced form, called non-alcoholic steatohepatitis or NASH, could lead to cirrhosis or cancer of the liver. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a Saudi-led coalition and Yemeni government forces are closing in on a Houthi-held port. Belgian federal prosecutors are investigating the shooting deaths of two female police officers and a third person Tuesday in the eastern city of Liege. Police suspect the shootings were terrorist-motivated. Officials said the gunman shot the officers in the morning outside a cafe on a major thoroughfare before fleeing to a high school where he briefly took a hostage. A spokesman for the Liege prosecutors, Catherine Collignon, told AFP the third victim was a motorist who was driving in the area. Belgian broadcaster RTBF said the attacker was released from prison on Monday and was shot dead by police. The broadcaster said the suspect was known for committing minor infractions and had no known association to extremism. Raffaello Pantucci is the director of international security studies at the London-based Royal United Services Institute. He spoke to me about the attack.
I mean, details are still emerging about this individual, but I think that it appears as though at this point that he may have discovered his sort of extremist ideas while he was incarcerated, and he was serving time for some drugs offenses. And it is in Bertrand prison and launched the attack pretty immediately. Certainly the rapidity with which he went from being in prison to a terrorist attack in which he murdered individuals would suggest some level of coordination, you know, if only for the fact that he tried to actually source the weapons that he needed to launch the attack. But whether we can specifically make all the connections up right now is still very difficult to know, because it's possible he used his criminal contacts to get the weapons as well. But I think certainly we're looking at something which was clearly organized to some degree and clearly reflects a particularly horrible terrorist attack.
Yes, and this suspect had apparently no known association to extremism.
Yeah, I mean, this is the interesting aspect of this one. I think what we've seen previously in the past is that we've seen individuals who sort of become involved or launched terrorist attacks or been involved in terrorist activity who were hit in the past on police security services radars as individuals of concern. I think with this case, what we're learning about it so far is that he was on police services radars before his criminal activity rather than his terrorist activity. So I think it does present us with a sort of a new model. I mean, it's worth pointing out that I think for some time now people have been growing more concerned about the growing proximity of sort of terrorist networks in parts of Europe with criminal fraternities. And so in some ways, I think what we're seeing here is a particularly violent expression of that. But, you know, I think that it is clearly, it's one of these things we should be very worried about, because if you're looking at people who are hardened criminals, they tend to have access to a lot of the tools which will help terrorism. And And they're also individuals who tend to have, you know, fairly hardened mentalities and be more willing to commit brutal activities.
The place in Belgium usually associated with terrorism or terrorist attacks has been Molenbeek in Brussels. This, of course, happened in Liège. It's sort of an interesting, very different place for something like this to occur. And also it involved police officers.
Well, I think that, you know, we still don't know the full contours of this individual, who he knew, how he was connected. You know, it could just be that the place he launched his attack just was sort of the most convenient location at that moment in time. That's where he found, you know, the two police officers. Belgium is not an immense country. It's sort of fairly easy to get across and around quite quickly. So it's possible that we may still reveal things to Molenbeek or other known places in the sort of fullness of time. I mean, I think that's to the point of him targeting female police officers. I think police officers have been a fairly regular target across Europe, including the United Kingdom, for some time now. Even in the United States, I think we've seen some evidence of this. You know, I think the Islamic State and other terrorist groups have been shouting about people to attack authority figures wherever they can find them. And police are kind of the most obvious authority figure that most people will come across in their day-to-day lives. So I think targeting police officers is not really that new. Even targeting female police officers is not necessarily that new. If we think back to the attacks in January 2015, where the Kouachi brothers attacked the Charlie Hebdo offices, and then subsequently we saw Amedi Coulibaly launch his own one-man terror campaign. You know, the first thing that Amedi Coulibaly did was shoot the female police officer in Paris before he then went over to a Jewish supermarket and took hostages and murdered people there. So, you know, targeting female police officers is not entirely new. I think from an ideological perspective, it ticks a lot of boxes. You know, sort of violent Islamist jihadist groups believe that police officers are sort of representatives of the enemy state that they're fighting, and females should not be fulfilling that sort of a work role. So it does sort of hit a double ideological tap from their perspective as well.
Rafael Pantucci, the Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute in London. Saudi-led coalition forces are claiming to have advanced to within fewer than 20 kilometers from Yemen's Houthi-held port city of Hodeidah. Saudi forces claim Iran has used Hodeidah to supply the Houthis with weapons. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Arab media close to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates say Yemeni forces fighting alongside the Saudi-led coalition have gained ground in the battle to retake Yemen's second-largest port of Hodeidah, which is held by the Iranian-backed Houthi militia and serves the capital, Sana'a. Amateur video showed forces fighting alongside the coalition with weaponry they claim to have captured from the Houthis as they fled their positions. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reported Houthi landmines and rockets captured near Hodeidah were made in Iran. VOA could not independently confirm the report. A young militia fighter with Saudi coalition forces from the United Arab Emirates and Sudan claimed his men were getting closer to Hodeidah. He says his men have achieved a major victory on the road toward Hodeidah. Saudi coalition spokesman Colonel Turki al-Maliki told journalists late Monday that Houthi forces defending Hodeidah were collapsing. He says troops loyal to the government of President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi have recently achieved a number of victories on several fronts, causing the widespread collapse of Houthi militia forces. He says Yemeni forces supported by the Saudi-led coalition had come to within 20 kilometers of the Red Sea port. Houthi leader Abdel Malik al-Houthi acknowledged in a speech Sunday his forces had suffered problems. He says there have been a number of setbacks on a number of fronts, as occurs normally in war for various logistic reasons, but that doesn't mean the end of the war. Some Arab media said Tariq Saleh, nephew of the late president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, has been fighting alongside the Saudi-led coalition. Saleh, who was the commander of his uncle's presidential guard unit, joined the battle to defeat the Houthis earlier this year after being urged to do so by the United Arab Emirates, where his family resides. The United Arab Emirates plays a major role in the Saudi-led coalition. Former Yemeni military officer and analyst Mohsen Naji Mossad told Arab media that at least three indigenous Yemeni militias are fighting alongside the Saudi-led coalition under the banner of President Hadi. He says militiamen from the southern Yemeni opposition, Salafi fighters, and forces close to the Muslim Brotherhood-supported Islah Party are fighting alongside the United Arab Emirates and Sudanese troops. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. A single from an international group is shooting up the charts. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins me with the details.
Today, we are going international, Sarah. Today, we're looking at a band who have done something that has never been done before in Billboard history. The first K-pop band to have a number one album on the Billboard charts, BTS. They are right now the rage. Everybody is talking about this Korean seven-member boy band who performed on the Billboard Award show recently, and they won a Billboard Award for Top Social Artist. They're on tour in the U.S. promoting their third album. Album number three is called Love Yourself, Tear. And as I said, it's the first K-pop band album to hit number one on Billboard, so congratulations to them. They started back in 2013. They called themselves at the time the Bangtan Boys. They've shortened it, obviously, for the international appeal to BTS. The group consists of V, Suga, Jin, Jungkook, RM, Jimin, and J-Hope. And they are just the rage right now. So we're going to listen to their brand new song, which is getting some attention and airplay here in the United States. And the song is called Fake Love. Here are BTS.
Speaking of K-pop, a number of years ago, there was that huge hit, Gangnam Style.
Gangnam Style, and he sang it was bilingual. It was, you know, much of it was in English by a very famous Psy, who's very famous in Korea. But this is the first boy band from Korea, K-pop boy band, because K-pop is huge around the world. In fact, this particular group have released three albums in Korean, but three in Japanese. And there just seems to be a fascination right now with Asian music and what's going on in the Asian music scene. The new album, Love Yourself, Tear, is the first foreign language album to hit number one in over 12 years. It's the first K-pop album ever, but we had a foreign language album 12 years ago reach number one on Billboard. And these guys have won many, many awards going back to their very first album, Too Cool for School. They got New Artist of the Year at a variety of different Asian award shows. The second album was Wings in 2016. It became their first million-selling album, sold over 1.5 million copies, got them the Artist of the Year Award at the Asian Music Awards. These guys are here in the United States right now. In fact, Time Magazine has named them one of the 25 most influential people on the internet, because these guys have attracted so many followers, hence the, you know, top social media act at the Billboard Award show. Their fans call them the Army. They refer to themselves as the Army, BTS's fan club. And I'm going to try and get them on board across things because I'd like to talk to these guys. I don't know how much English they speak.
Uh-huh.
When they accepted the award at the Billboard show, they were kind of very reluctant to say a whole lot.
Right.
But, you know, maybe we can get them on VOA and that would be wonderful. But right now they're the rage and they're it.
And we have a VOA Korean service. They could probably help you out.
There you go. That would be wonderful. And I know, by the way, last year, Guinness Book of World Records revealed BTS had earned a spot in the 2018 edition for having the world's most Twitter engagements for a group at over a half a billion.
Wow.
So congratulations to BTS. They're here to stay.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossing. Well, the music of BTS closes our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, some 815 million people suffer chronically from hunger. And although this is significantly fewer people than the numbers we saw a decade ago, hunger still kills more people than AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. On May 28th, we observe World Hunger Day. It is an effort to focus attention on the fact that despite a sufficient availability of food nearly everywhere, globally some 21,000 people die every day from hunger or malnutrition. People do not go hungry because the world does not produce enough food for everyone. According to the World Hunger Education Service, over the past three decades, significant growth in food production, along with improved access to food, helped reduce the percentage of chronically undernourished people in developing countries from 34% to 15%. The principal problem is that many people in the world still do not have resources to purchase or grow enough food. Indeed, hunger is a consequence of poverty and also one of its causes. Hunger exists because many countries lack social safety nets, because in many countries women, although they do most of the farming, do not have as much access as men to training, credit, or land. Conflict, governance systems that do not encourage investment in agriculture, poor management of land and natural resources, lack of educational opportunity, displacement of small farmers by natural disasters, and financial and economic crises that eliminate jobs at the lowest levels all contribute toward creating conditions that push the poorest into hunger. Over the past decade, a global push to reduce hunger and extreme poverty has marked some significant successes, thanks in part to the efforts of numerous international and transnational institutions, foundations, NGOs, and governments, including the United States. But on World Hunger Day, let us not forget that with over 815,000 people still living in daily food insecurity, we still have a long way to go before we can safely say that no child goes to bed hungry most nights, that no parent skimps on their own dinner so the children can eat.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.